reminds me of that other album that we have called Beethoven's Fifth. So this is Latin Explosion. Thank you so much. Stay tuned, and I'll see you in 1 week.
On WSLR, LP 96.5 FM in Sarasota, and WBPV, LP 100.1 FM in Bradenton, I'm Ryan Stanley with your WSLR news headlines for Friday, January 24th. Sarasota County firefighters, joined by crews from the Longboat Key Fire Department, tackled a two-alarm structure fire on Thursday at Rochelle's Boutique in the 300 block of St. Armand Circle. The fire was reported just before noon, according to Tina Adams, a spokesperson for Longboat Key Fire Rescue. Traffic was temporarily blocked in the area, but St. Armand Circle reopened as of 3 p.m. Thursday. South Boulevard of the Presidents, heading away from the circle, remained closed until emergency services cleared the scene and may remain closed during the investigation process. The cause of the fire is still unknown. Speaking of fire departments, big changes are ahead for fire services in Nokomis after a decision by the Sarasota County Commission. Currently, Nokomis residents fund the Nokomis Volunteer Fire Department with a $100 donation. Starting in the 2025 tax year, they'll instead pay a fire assessment to support the Sarasota County Fire Department. The rate, set at $10.35 per $1,000 of property value, means a 2,500 square foot single-family home will pay $258.75 annually, a nearly 160% increase. County staff will now work with the property appraiser and tax collector to include the revised funding model in next year's property taxes. And like millions of Americans, us right here on the Suncoast have faced extreme cold warnings earlier this week that continue as Arctic blasts sweep across the United States. While much of the country is now returning to normal temperatures, the cold lingers here in Florida, with a cold weather advisory in effect for the Suncoast until 10 a.m. today and likely to be extended overnight into Saturday. Wind chills are expected to dip into the 20s by Saturday morning. And the National Weather Service has issued a freeze watch for inland Manatee County during the same period. For boaters, a small craft exercise caution statement remains in effect along coastal waters. Residents, you are urged to take precautions to stay safe in the cold. Bring your pets indoors, cover or move temperature-sensitive plants, ensure your heaters are used correctly to prevent fire hazards. Dress in warm layers, limit time outdoors, and check in on your neighbors. Fortunately, rain is unlikely as the day goes on. This Friday, sunshine will prevail and highs will be in the upper 50s today and mid-60s tomorrow. This has been Ryan Stanley with your WSLR News headlines for Friday, January 24th.
You're listening to WSLR, LP 96.5 FM in Sarasota and WBPV, LP 100.1 FM in Bradenton, who at the Music and Arts venue Fogartyville provide a center for creative expression and community engagement that amplifies the voices of our diverse community and promotes peace, sustainability, democracy, and economic and social justice. I am Lou Larini, and thanks for tuning in to Surreal News, where we offer opinions, comments, and perspective on the events of the week, which do not necessarily represent the station, its board, or anyone else other than the person who expressed them. The days of wishful thinking that maybe he was just kidding with all that bluster on the campaign trail was just hyperbole, but day one came, and by the time it went, some foundations of our fragile democracy were shaken. For instance, the blanket pardoning of convicted J6 insurrectionists, including those on tape assaulting Capitol Police, has turned the rule of law from a blind adherence to defined perceptions of right and wrong to the perception of one man. Who will be pardoned next, and how much might it cost to get that arbitrary special treatment? While the dismantling of justice is damaging to the country, turning away from efforts to reduce climate change are damaging the planet. Stay tuned until half past the hour to hear my interview with Julie McNamara, Deputy Policy Director with the Climate and Energy Program at the Union of Concerned Scientists. We'll discuss why slowing the transition to clean energy is an existential threat to us all. But first, hear how what at first sounds like a typical silly Trump vanity project is a way for anyone, including foreign countries, to anonymously bribe the President of the United States. On Monday, Donald Trump took the oath of office, the first person to be sworn in as president while simultaneously hawking an opponent's meme coin. Trump launched Strump, spelled with the dollar sign as the S, a crypto token on Friday night. Meme coins are crypto tokens tied to a celebrity or joke. The first and most famous is Dogecoin, a cryptocurrency centered around the famous image of a Shiba Inu dog. Strump, an attempt last summer. Trump is leveraging the prestige of the presidency and the global price of Strump. By Strump, coin soared to over $75, putting the value of the 200 million Strump coins in circulation at nearly $15 billion. By Monday afternoon, Strump had lost about 40% of its vast speculative activity as Trump himself. In a move that raised red flags even among crypto enthusiasts, 80% of all Strump coins are reserved for a company owned by Trump. At its peak, the value of these coins exceeded $50 billion, making Strump, which did not exist a few days ago, the dominant source of Trump's wealth. The Strump coins owned by Trump are currently locked, meaning they cannot be sold, but will be released in tranches over the next 3 years. In 2016, Trump's net worth was estimated to be about $3 billion. Before the launch of Strump, it had increased to around $7 billion, largely due to public listing of Truth Social's parent company, Trump Media and Technology Group. Truth Social loses millions of dollars every quarter and has few users, but Trump's fans keep the stock price elevated. So Trump has huge financial incentive to keep the price of Strump elevated until he can sell his coins. For Trump, there's nothing but upside. He received the coins for free. Whatever he can sell them for will be a windfall. Trump's supporters, however, could suffer huge financial losses. By Monday afternoon, a single Strump coin cost $40. People who buy these coins looking to turn a profit could instead find themselves with massive losses. Strump does not only create problems for reckless Trump fans, it means the White House is for sale. Anyone seeking to curry favor with Trump, including foreign governments, now has a vehicle to transfer a virtually unlimited amount of money to Trump by driving up the price of Strump coins. As with all crypto transactions, anyone can purchase Strump anonymously. The only record involves a digital wallet with no public owner. This means a foreign entity could make large purchase of Strump coins, perhaps boosting Strump's value before Trump sold some of his holdings, and no one would know. It creates an unprecedented and completely opaque method to bribe the President of the United States. While it's tempting to dismiss this as just another Trump spectacle, the launch of the official token opens up a Pandora's box of ethical and regulatory questions. Justin Anathin, an independent crypto analyst, told Reuters, "Thousands of meme coins are launched every month. The failure rate for meme coins is estimated at over 97%. With so much competition, it's hard to make a significant number of people become aware of a meme coin. Trump, as President of the United States, solves that problem. But even once people discover a meme coin, it needs to be easy to buy and sell in order to sustain interest." Reproductive rights are changing, but you'll have to guess how now that the info from the government has been shut down. Government website that provided information on reproductive rights appears to have gone offline around the same time Donald Trump returned to office. Newsweek has contacted the Trump Fans Transition Team and the Department of Health and Human Services for comment via email. In 2022, the Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade, the 1973 ruling that protected women's rights to choose to have an abortion. The court's three Trump-appointed justices ruled with the majority in overturning the ruling. Trump, who takes credit for overturning Roe v. Wade, has long said states should have the power to decide their own abortion policies and has explicitly said that he would veto a national abortion ban. But on Monday, CBS News reported that the site reproductiverights.gov appeared to be offline on the evening of Trump's inauguration, and this remained the case as of Tuesday morning. It is unclear when the site went down, but it was active as recently as January 15th, when it was last archived on the Wayback Machine. The Department of Health and Human Services launched the site in 2022 as part of a public awareness campaign about reproductive health. The site includes a Know Your Rights section that said, while Roe v. Wade was overturned, abortion remains legal in many states, and other reproductive health care services remain protected by law. The U.S. Department of Health and Human Services is committed to providing you with accurate and up-to-date information about access to and coverage of reproductive health care and resources. Our goal is to make sure you get appropriate information and support. At the top of the site, an update on medication abortion said the Supreme Court decision in June ensured mifepristone medicine remained available under the conditions of use approved by the FDA. The Biden-Harris administration remains committed to protecting abortion rights, ensuring women can make their own decisions about their own bodies, and preserving the FDA's authority to make science-based determination about what medications are safe and effective, the page said. Trump has faced pressure from parts of the anti-abortion movement for not taking a harder line on the issue. Before the election, Lila Rose, the founder of the anti-abortion organization Live Action, said, "It is wrong for Trump supporters to demand that pro-life activists be endlessly loyal to Trump in response to repeated betrayal." She said Trump was losing pro-life votes. Nancy Northrup, the president and CEO of the Center for Reproductive Rights, said in a statement on Monday, expecting even more extreme actions in this second term. "We are on high alert and prepared to sue at a moment's notice. Our fighting force of lawyers is prepared to block or delay the administration's most harmful actions. We will be in court every day for the next 4 years, if that's what it takes." At the ready to support us are hundreds of pro bono attorneys from top firms, many of whom have worked for the very agencies we are prepared to sue and know their inner workings. We are already anticipating the tactics the administration will use and are preparing cases to act swiftly and aggressively. Florida Policy Institute correctly predicted the rising cost of the Florida voucher program. 2 years after the Florida Policy Institute predicted a high price tag for Florida's universal school vouchers, the independent nonprofit's analysts say it's coming true. A new report from the Institute finds that the vouchers will cost the state an estimated $3.9 billion in the 2024-25 school year. When the bill was signed, the Institute estimated it would cost $4 billion each school year. This cost includes both types of vouchers, the Florida Empowerment Scholarships and the Florida Tax Credit Scholarships. The 2023 law lifted income and enrollment restrictions, opening the vouchers to almost every family in Florida. But to fund these vouchers, the state has had to get the money from somewhere. FPI analysts say it's coming from public schools. Governor Ron DeSantis recently said the voucher program gives all students access to the high-quality education they need. "Florida is the number one state for education because of our commitment to providing every student with the option that works best for them," DeSantis said. This year, over 500,000 scholarships were awarded, one-third of the total vouchers given out in the country. Dollard said people are taking unfair advantage of the program. While the vouchers were supposed to be aimed at helping low-income families get their children into private schools, students who are already enrolled in these schools were more common recipients. So, we estimate that about 70% of the voucher students in a public school before, Dollard said. So, they're already in private school, so this was just tuition assistance for them. In the 2021-22 school year, 12% of the state's education budget went to private school vouchers. This year, that amount has nearly doubled, coming in at 23%. As a result, state funding for public schools has decreased from 88% to 77%, according to the FPI. But the majority of families are still turning to public schools rather than private ones, Dollard pointed out. Florida parents overwhelmingly choose public education, she said. Dollard says this hurts students in neighborhoods that already have undersourced schools. She warned that Florida is seeing the beginnings of a resegregation in schools now. Executive Director of Families for Strong Public Schools, Demarius Allen, said the voucher program spells trouble for both public and private schools. While vouchers siphon students and money out of public schools, they still have overhead costs that need to be covered. Meanwhile, private schools can become overwhelmed with students and unable to support them. She also said that students may not be getting a better education at private school because they're not accredited. So, we're going to continue to see this play out where a system isn't good for anyone, Allen said. The FTC scholarship is no longer limited to families under 185% of federal poverty level. While priority is still given to those families, those making anywhere under 400% can receive the scholarship. For both FES categories, the financial eligibility restrictions and enrollment requirement cap were eliminated. As a result, Dollard said, the high price tag is due in part to the increasing applications for scholarships. Dollard said the personalized education program designed for homeschoolers under the FTC scholarship category still has a capacity limit, although that will go away by 2027. Allen's concern with PEP is that while parents are getting just as much money as a private school would to educate the student, they don't have to cover the same overhead costs. But DeSantis continues boasting about the program's popularity, encouraging the rest of the country, particularly the Trump administration and the U.S. Congress, to take note. So we're hoping that they will consider looking at Florida's model for education choice and applying that nationally, he said. You're listening to WSLR LP 96.5 FM in Sarasota and WVPV LP 100.1 FM in Bradenton. Didn't take long for a governor to hop on board the preposterous Trump claim train. Florida Governor Ron DeSantis referred to the Gulf of Mexico as the Gulf of America in an executive order this week addressing a winter weather system moving into parts of the Sunshine State. Whereas an area of low pressure moving across the Gulf of America interacting with Arctic air will bring widespread impactful winter weather to North Florida beginning on Tuesday, January 21st, 2025, the DeSantis order states. The move came just hours after President Trump pledged to rename the Gulf of Mexico the Gulf of America during his inaugural address, re-upping a proposal he floated during a wide-ranging press conference earlier this month at his Palm Beach resort. A short time from now, we're going to be changing the name of the Gulf of Mexico to the Gulf of America, and we will restore the name of a great president, William McKinley, to Mount McKinley, where it should be and where it belongs, Trump said shortly after being sworn in, referring to the Alaska Mountain now known as Denali. DeSantis was in Washington on Monday for the inauguration. The governor has signaled an eagerness to use his position as governor to implement Trump's agenda. Last week, DeSantis called for special legislative session in Florida in an effort to aid the administration in enacting Trump's immigration agenda. In what may go down as the final act of kindness by the federal government, Leonard Pelletier was freed. Joe Biden, in one of his final acts as president this week, commuted the life sentence of Native American rights activist Leonard Pelletier, who was convicted of killing two FBI agents on the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation and of escaping from federal prison. Pelletier, who is 80 years old and has been in prison for almost five decades, he has been in declining health in recent years from diabetes, hypertension, partial blindness from a stroke, and bouts of COVID. In a statement, the White House said the commutation will enable Pelletier to spend his remaining days in home confinement, but will not pardon him for his underlying crimes. Pelletier's daughter, Kathy Pelletier, said she was in shock after learning that Biden had done after past presidential requests for clemency were unsuccessful. "I'm just thankful that he had the balls and the guts to do it," she said of Biden's decision. The family of one of the two agents fatally shot, Jack Kohler, expressed frustration on Monday, arguing that the parole board rejection of supervised release in June was based on a sincere review of the case. The Kohler family is frustrated and very angry after years fighting to keep Pelletier incarcerated, it said. The board decided against granting Pelletier parole. This fact makes President Biden's decision for a last-minute commutation more surprising and extremely disappointing. In a statement provided by the NDN Collective, an indigenous-led advocacy organization, Pelletier said he was ready to leave prison. "It's finally over. I'm going home," Pelletier said. "I want to show the world that I'm a good person with a good heart." The U.S. Parole Commission in July denied Pelletier's latest bid for release, which left his fate in the hands of Biden. Pelletier has long maintained his innocence, and his commutation has drawn fierce opposition from members of law enforcement who contend that his two consecutive life sentences are just in the fatal shootings of FBI agents Kohler and Ron Williams in 1975 in South Dakota. Christopher Wray, who became FBI director in 2017 before he retired Monday as President Donald Trump took office for a second term, had tried to persuade Biden not to commute Pelletier's sentence, arguing in a letter this month that it would be wholly unjustified and would be an affront to the rule of law. "Mr. President, I urge you in the strongest terms possible, do not pardon Leonard Pelletier or cut his sentence short," Wray wrote. Biden's commutation announcement came just minutes before Trump's inauguration. Trump did not act on Pelletier's clemency request during his first term, and other presidents, Democratic and Republican alike, also declined to intervene. Pelletier told NBC News in 2022 that he wasn't interested in a presidential pardon because it would be granted for a crime he insists he is innocent of. Instead, he said he wanted the opportunity to get out of prison and get a new trial. Over the decades, human rights and faith leaders, including Pope Francis and the Dalai Lama, and Nobel Peace Prize recipients such as Nelson Mandela and Bishop Desmond Tutu, have backed changes to the ACA will potentially affect 24 million Americans. In a move that has significant impact, Donald Trump has issued a series of executive orders, some of which target the healthcare marketplace. These changes in the process and medical insurance coverage for an estimated 24 million people. The Affordable Care Act, a cornerstone of healthcare in the United States since its enactment in 2010, roughly 24 million Americans have purchased health insurance via the ACA this year. Trump's recent changes will impact key provisions, including enrollment deadlines, eligibility. This could result in reduced access to affordable health care. On January 20th, 2025, Trump signed pieces of a series of executive orders. Two were aimed at reversing several key elements of the Affordable Care Act that were implemented during the Biden administration. This included rescinding President Biden's 2021 Executive Order 14009, which expanded open enrollment periods for ACA plans, as well as a 2022 Executive Order 14070, which aimed to lower ACA premiums. President Donald Trump in the executive orders said the previous administration has embedded deeply unpopular, inflationary, illegal, and radical practices within every agency and office of the federal government. He added, it is the policy of the United States to restore common sense to federal government and unleash the potential of the American citizen. The revocations within this order will be the first of many steps the United States federal government will take to repair our institutions and our economy. Alex Bean, financial literacy instructor at the University of Tennessee at Martin, told Newsweek, while we don't know what the actual effects will be, it's fair to say the reversal in trajectory from President Biden, fewer Americans enrolling in insurance under the Affordable Care Act, that executive order extended enrollment periods for many states, and excelled funding from outside entities to assist Americans in enrolling. The rescinding of it could return those enrollments to time periods to their original length and cause assistance through third parties to decrease over time. Kevin Thompson, founder and CEO of 91 Capital Group, told Newsweek, third-party funding played a significant role in boosting ACA participation. These funds, along with government subsidies, helped offset premiums for millions of Americans, driving the enrollment gains seen in recent years. A reduction in this funding will likely lead to lower enrollment numbers. The most vulnerable populations will be the hardest hit. Non-expansion states, many of which are red states, tend to have higher percentage of their populations enrolled in the ACA marketplace. These states will face significant challenges with shorter enrollment periods and reduced subsidies. What was once campaigned as "we won't touch entitlements" is now coming dangerously close to contradicting that promise. A massive wind farm project has already been killed. The president stopped building work on over 100,000 acres of clean energy infrastructure at the Lava Ridge Wind Project in Idaho via an executive order this week. The move is part of a series of day one promises that Trump pledged to fulfill once he was sworn in. In his inauguration speech, Trump said the U.S. would drill, baby, drill and expand oil and gas initiatives at the expense of renewable energy projects. This order, along with his removal of the U.S. from the Paris Climate Agreement, symbolizes Trump's move towards traditional fuel sources. The Lava Ridge Wind Project would have been a 400,000-acre wind farm in Lava Ridge, Idaho, with over 271 turbines planned by developers Magic Valley Energy. That would have made Lava Ridge the largest wind farm in the U.S. by area, beating out the 100,000-acre title holder in Roscoe, Texas. However, because of the project's scale, it was met with skepticism by local campaigners, including Republican Iowa Senator Jim Risch. In 2023, Iowa lawmakers issued a statement with concerns over how the project was being managed by the Bureau of Land Management. Local campaign groups such as the Friends of Minidoka were concerned that the construction would impact the Minidoka National Historic Site, which was the location of an internment camp for Japanese Americans during World War II. Trump signed the executive order, which was co-written by Risch, on Monday, with Risch saying, by prioritizing this executive action on the first day in office, President Trump further cements his legacy as a leader in the revolution. Common sense that governs by the people and for the people. Risch said in a statement on the order, I made a promise to Idahoans that I would not rest until Lava Ridge Wind Project was terminated. On day one, President Trump took action to keep that promise. It isn't yet clear whether the project has been canceled altogether and whether there will be any challenges to the decision. You're listening to WSLR LP 96.5 FM in Sarasota and WBPV LP 100.1 FM in Bradenton. Up next is my interview with Julie McNamara.
I'm Lou Lorenian. I'm pleased to welcome Julie McNamara, Deputy Policy Director with the Climate and Energy Program at the Union of Concerned Scientists, whose mission is to put rigorous independent science into action, developing solutions and advocating for a healthy, safe, and just future. Thanks for making time for us today, Julie. How you doing?
Thanks for having me. Good to speak with you.
Great. Tell us a little bit about yourself and how you came to work with UCS.
Sure. Well, I've always had a passion for science and for understanding the technical behind the policy, but I also care a lot about achieving good ends for people and the environment. And so I came to the Union of Concerned Scientists, an organization that prioritizes science in the policymaking process as a way to advance environmental interests, public health protections, all tied to the underlying science.
Yeah, with that mission, I can imagine, everybody there is, watching their plates get very full. Right away.
That's right. You know, there's just from the very jump, our name, Union of Concerned Scientists, we care deeply about that policies reflect the real and actual science, with an idea that science can be used for the public good. And what we know of this administration from the jump is that they will do everything they can to bury science if it is inconvenient to their aims. And we see that again and again across climate, across public health, across so many issues, the subversion of science to prioritize often the interests of a select polluting few.
Yeah. According to your bio on the UCS website, facilitate a rapid, sustained, and broadly beneficial transition of our nation's energy system. The Biden administration was trying to shift energy sources to clean options, mainly wind and solar, but even though it wasn't as effective as they had hoped, but boy, at least they were giving it a good shot and an effort. But obviously there's a new sheriff in town, and that, shall we say, has become less of a priority. A massive wind farm project, I'm sure you've already read about, has already been stopped already. And what's going to be the consequences of slowing or stopping altogether efforts to increase wind and solar power production and decrease, I guess, carbon pollution?
Yeah, so this is a great question. And I think it's really something where we have to hold two truths at once. The clean energy transition is inevitable. We see again and again and again that renewables outperform fossil fuel on cost, on cleanliness, on reliability. And businesses see the economic case for making this transition. Homeowners see the case for making this transition. Corporations that work all across the globe know that to be leaders, to have that lead in innovation, that they need to be committed to the clean energy transition. So these things won't simply go away as the Trump administration comes in. And yet, it is also the case that this transition is not happening anywhere near as fast as it must for us to meet our climate targets. It's just not, which means that we need policies that help put the pedal to the floor, right, to accelerate this transition. And we now have an administration coming in that is doing absolutely everything it can to not just slow the transition, but reverse it. They will not succeed, but they will have real power in slowing it. And that is going to bring real costs and consequences to people all across the country, right? It can be in little ways, in insidious shifts, in how we say the costs of public health harms, right, from pollution, from burning fossil fuels, how that shows up in a cost-benefit analysis to attempt to justify weakening pollution standards, right, making it cheaper for fossil fuels to compete. It can be in far bigger ways in attempting to fully sideline clean energy resources like offshore wind, which have incredible potential in parts of our country to contribute, especially right, as these large providers of reliable, ongoing, clean electricity generation. So these things can really run the gamut, but when you put all the different pieces together, it's just a relentless attack on the potential for clean energy to be contributing as much as it can, as fast as it can. and just this desperate attempt to try to forestall that transition.
Yeah, and of course, you know, the elephant in the room is clean energy's main competitor is dirty energy, which is created by fossil fuel, and the fossil fuel producers, I believe were told by the incoming president, you guys give me $1 billion and I'll let you do whatever you want.
That's right. That's exactly right. And we're already seeing it. Now, it's critical to remember, fossil fuel companies don't want to just produce more and more and more. They want to produce at lower cost to pad their profits, right? And so it's while the Trump administration is talking about bringing down energy prices, their actions are really about how to cut corners so fossil fuel companies can cut costs to pad their profits, not for the benefit of the public, not for lowering energy costs, not for making it cheaper to run businesses or to pay utility bills, simply to make it cheaper for fossil fuel companies to do their business. Those quote benefits won't be coming back to the American public. Those will simply be going to fossil fuel executives.
Yeah, and I guess it's important to point out that, at least from what I read, it's gotten to be old hat, fossil fuel companies, oil companies, continually post record profits, every quarter. I mean, it's just astounding, how much money that they're already making. So, one question I want to ask you, it sounds a little humorous, but I mean, the president's famously railed against wind turbines. Is there really a downside to producing electricity with wind compared to, the benefits of reducing pollution?
Wind resources power approximately 10% of our electricity mix today. They are an incredibly valuable contributor to our electricity mix, and they're so often providing at exactly those times when we need them most. Now, that's not to say that, every resource has its place, right? We wouldn't want, wind turbines can't be put up just anywhere. But we know that they have brought incredible amounts of investments to communities all across the country, good jobs, new manufacturing. They continue to produce in ways that just point to this forward-looking economy, right? The thing that somebody can build a future on, not try to cling to jobs that are so clearly on their way out. And so we have seen that policymakers on both sides of the aisle will stand up for clean energy resources. There will be rhetorical flourishes that attempt to obscure support for renewables. But when it comes to actually making policy changes, they'll say, no, we still want to see support for renewable resources because they are bringing unbelievable amounts of money, including to rural areas, right? This is an opportunity to produce electricity in and around communities. Local energy independence, this is something that everybody should be excited about. And when it comes down to the local level, people so often are to have the freedom to produce their own electricity, including with, say, solar panels on rooftops or community energy resources. These are the things that just bring such great community benefits, drive down prices, help to divorce us from global price swings of fossil fuels. But when we have policymakers who see the benefit of speaking just rhetoric alone about, say, energy dominance, renewables are getting caught in the crossfire. Again, when you go down to the local level, people want the opportunity to access, to benefit from clean energy resources.
That's absolutely right. I just read recently in the Washington Post, I forget who said it, but the guy pointed out that, the technology is here. And it's government basically that has lagged behind. And this is even a government, like the one led by Joe Biden that has tried, heroically, to try to encourage people, to do more with, renewables and sustainable energy. So that's, I hear you. I mean, that's the issue. You can put solar panels on your roof and produce an awful lot of the electricity that you use. And that kind of energy independence is, something that used to be, I don't know, kind of the figment of a science fiction writer's mind, right? I mean, but it's here now.
It is, and costs keep coming down and down and down, and so clean energy coupled with battery storage is becoming incredibly accessible. Now, it's not universally accessible, and that's the type of place where policy is useful, right, to help bridge, to ensure that everybody has access, that this isn't something that's just, we've already seen policies help drive down costs for all of these resources just at incredible pace and with just enormous cost reductions far greater than was ever anticipated on this timeline. And yet, of course, there is still so much more to do. This is the type of thing where one would hope that policymakers would put their heads together and design that find the gaps in the steps to this clean energy economy, challenging pieces, because it doesn't often pushes nudges. We want policymakers to be trying to see what our environment needs. We see the mounting toll of our burdening communities all across the country. These are the things we storm. We'll get through this, but it comes year on year on year, times within a season. That's crushing to municipal budgets. And people know that we need real solutions. I think it is without question, right, that people want to see their policymakers act and what that looks like, what they're across the aisle. But I think when you really get down to it, people, they want to know that their policymakers are trying.
You're listening to WSLR LP 96.5 FM in Sarasota and WBPV LP 100.1 FM in Bradenton. And I'm speaking with Julie McNamara.
There are some, of course, you know, that, you know, recognize, you know, the science, you know, I mean, you know, the you know, but then, of course, you know, we get, you know, the climate denier in the White House who doesn't even want to admit that the planet is warming and is so transactional that, you know, wind can't pay him anything, I guess. So, you know, he isn't for it. I know this is, you know, early on in the term, and we do know about that one giant, massive wind farm in, I guess, Idaho it was, that was shut down. Have you heard of any other that have been put on hold so far?
Yeah, well, in that flurry of orders, there are a number of actions that are going to put an immediate pause on support for the clean energy transition. So, you know, executive orders are often directional. They often do not have force in and of themselves, right? A stroke of a pen. They cannot simply rescind a regulation. But there were multiple points of direction that would, for example, pause the disbursement of funds that have already been passed into law to support investments in clean energy manufacturing, loans that the government is legally obligated to pay, the potential for grants on numerous clean energy incentives. All of these are now currently paused as the government is directing agencies to consider whether that would cause undue burden to fossil fuels. Now, I think, first of all, this dance is on the edge of illegal, right? What the government is legally obligated to pay the funds it owes people. Moreover, though, this points to a just blatant attempted cash grab to take from those investments that are trying to drive the economy forward and redirect them to subsidizing fossil fuels. It just becomes clearer and clearer that fossil fuel can't compete in the world as it's going. And so trying a lot of these backhanded approaches to further entrench themselves for another day. The thing is, policymakers, again, on both sides of the aisle, don't want to see multi-billion dollar investments suddenly stopped, work orders paused for things that could build out jobs, local economies that are pointed towards the future, right? It's orienting the clean energy economy. That's the thing that will be sustainable and something that can be built upon in the years and decades to come. Those investments are very popular back home, right, in districts. And so what actually comes of this, I think, remains to be seen.
Yeah, you know, your point about it being illegal, I always thought that, you know, once Congress, you know, approved a funding allocation like they did for the, you know, Inflation Reduction Act, which I believe contains a lot of really important tax credits to support and promote clean energy, they're obligated to pay it. They're obligated to follow through. Once Congress approves spending, they got to spend it, right? I mean, that's at least that's the way I understand the process. And what you've just described to me is, you know, they're trying to, I guess, go through agencies to slow it all down, make them reconsider, I guess.
Yes, and I think we'll be hearing a lot more about impoundment in the time ahead, the potential for the president to put a pause on funds that Congress has obligated. You know, Congress has to pass laws to change the flow of funds. The president cannot simply, right, we've been down this road before, and the Impoundment Act, and courts have repeatedly ruled in on this issue, right? And so I think we'll be seeing a lot more fights on this in the time to come. But one thing that it, no matter what happens, it allows for the delay, the disruption of investments, the potential faltering of investments of projects that were planned. These are the types of things that, but maybe the money ultimately does go through, but maybe then it's too late. Always, always at the end of the day, for fossil fuels, the biggest benefit for them is delay, because it buys another day.
An important point, you know, to make is that, you know, clean energy, you know, large-scale wind farm or large-scale solar farms, you know, can't necessarily be built next to where people need the energy. So power transmission is a key part of the puzzle, you know, and I would think, you know, creating, you know, or being able to put that energy onto the grid where people, you know, to get to the people who need it and be able to use it, absolutely requires cooperation from the government. I mean, that's big job, right? I mean, those lines.
That's right. There's so much potential for large infrastructure investments that would build out the foundations of this clean energy economy. These investments in infrastructure that are so long overdue, even setting aside climate change, clean energy, our electricity transmission system, our electricity grid, is incredibly outdated and ill-equipped for the extreme weather that we're now facing. Investing in building out that infrastructure in a way that doesn't just increase flexibility and its ability to bring online more, drives down costs for utility bills. And this is the type of thing that fossil fuel companies do not want to see, because it enables the displacement of coal and gas-fired generation.
Yeah, not to mention the fact that, you know, the creation of all these very important things also creates a lot of people in large sectors of the country. And I think possibly, as I've read, sections of the country where they need.
That's right. The clean energy economy has incredible benefits. It brings local investments that will be there and ongoing for a long time to come. It brings good-paying jobs that are oriented around that future forward-looking economy. These are the types of things that every policymaker should be and is fighting for in their districts. You know, we saw multiple times Republicans who would complain and be irate about the Inflation Reduction Act, and yet when projects would then be announced in their districts, they'd be there and claiming credit for those funds, because ultimately people do see this as the types of things that as a country we should be excited and thrilled about investing in. It brings so many potential benefits. And when the politics are stripped away, it's very clear that these are the right types of industrial policy going to work to orient our country towards the future. When politics are brought back in, that message can get muddied. And then when a president comes in who has pledged fealty to fossil fuel executives for funding his campaign, we see what we've seen this week, actions that are not for the betterment of the American public, not for the betterment of economics, not for the betterment of global standing, simply for the betterment of fossil fuel profits.
Yeah, you know, as the segment is, you know, winding down in our area of expertise, but, you know, from what you know, and it's a reduced climate change or you know, you just got to look at the weather of the last year, you know, with, you know, the massive hurricanes in Florida and the still burning wildfires in California, you know, and I know one of the hurricanes in Florida affected me personally. Started, you know, how fast it intensified. This is
I'm sorry to hear that. Yeah, it's incredibly devastating. And we've seen again and again and again across the country. There's no getting around the fact that climate change is here and having consequences today. And yet, we cannot lose sight of the fact that every degree to which we act lessens the level of harm we'll experience down the road. And so, more and you do it faster, we could never give that we do take will make it better than if we hadn't. And so it's again, it's a two truths at once. It's not enough, and it's always better.
Beautiful. You know, on that note, you know, I really want to thank you, Julie McNamara, from Union of Concerned Scientists, you know, for joining us today and so open some eyes, you know, to the danger we're in, even though I think a lot of my listeners already know. So, you know, thanks again, Julie, for making time for us today. You have a great day.
Apparently, lower prescription drug prices was not a good idea for the new commander-in-chief. In response to Donald Trump rolling back Biden-Harris administration efforts to lower drug costs for Americans, DNC Rapid Response Director Alex Floyd released the following statement. Donald Trump is already following through on some drugs to appease his billionaire backers after the Biden-Harris administration took on Big Pharma and won. Trump is again proving that he lied to the American people and doesn't care about lowering costs, only what's best for himself and his ultra-rich friends. Executive orders are hereby being revoked. Executive Order 14087, as of October 14, 2022, lowering prescription drug costs for Americans. Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services. President Biden issued Executive Order 1407, lowering prescription drug costs for Americans, to further address prescription drug affordability through the work of the Centers of Medicare and Medicaid Services and Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Innovation. The Innovation Center tests innovation payment and service delivery models designed to reduce program expenditures while preserving or enhancing the quality of care furnished to its beneficiaries. Trump said that there's a lot you can do to cut Medicare and Medicaid, programs that millions of American families rely on. Trump proposed cuts to Medicare and Medicaid in every state, siding with Big Pharma over hardworking Americans. Stat News reported, in a little noticed move, Trump Commerce Department unit has proposed a new rule that would prevent the federal government from using a controversial legal provision known as march-in rights to combat the high price of products developed with taxpayer dollars. And if adopted, the change may rise to lower prescription drug costs, according to consumer advocates. The Washington Post noted his avowed record as president. Each of his presidential budgets, White House budget proposals, included cuts to Social Security and Medicare programs. In his FY18, FY19, and FY20 and FY21 budgets, Trump repeatedly proposed hundreds of billions of dollars in cuts to Medicaid. The New York Times reported the Trump administration said on Thursday that it would allow states to cap Medicaid spending for many poor adults, a major shift along sought by conservatives that gives states the option of reducing health benefits for millions who gain coverage through these programs under the Affordable Care Act. Growing up in Panama City, Nadine Smith remembers watching Anita Bryant on television almost daily, using her sing-songy voice to sell Florida orange juice. She also remembers when the former pageant took a sharp pivot. She was a benign guest on television who suddenly turned into this malevolent presence that was saying awful things, Smith said, a longtime LGBTQ plus activist who is currently the executive director of Equality Florida. 70s from citrus industry spokesperson to Christian crusader against gay rights cemented her legacy as one of the most potent anti-LGBTQ plus activists of her time. It's a legacy that lives on in Florida politics today in the wake of her death last month at 84. After 2 decades as an entertainer with several albums and a performance at President Lyndon B. Johnson's funeral under her belt, Bryant launched the Save Our Children Coalition in 1977. The group targeted a Miami-Dade County ordinance banning plantation, which Bryant said at the time, condones immorality and discriminates against my children's rights to grow up in a healthy, decent community. She argued that because they couldn't reproduce, gay people turned to children to recruit more members to their ranks. Stephen Rothas, a longtime South Florida journalist covering LGBTQ issues, told Axios. The campaign was successful. Miami-Dade voters turned out in droves to repeal the policy. The same year, Florida lawmakers passed a ban on gay adoption that was repealed only a decade ago. Maligning LGBTQ plus people as a threat to children worked then and works now, Rothas said. Restrictions on trans health care are bolstered by slogans like "Let kids be kids." A 2023 law curtailing drag shows came out of rhetoric that such performances sexualize children. Florida parental rights and education law, dubbed "Don't Say Gay" by critics, was born from the false claim that learning or reading about LGBTQ people would turn children gay or trans. Have defended such laws as protecting a parent's right to exert control over how to talk to their children about sexual orientation and gender identity. Even that way of thinking stems directly from Bryant's advocacy. Anthony Verdugo, executive director of the Conservative Christian Family Coalition, told Axios, "People think the parental rights movement is new, when in reality, it's been around for half a century," Verdugo said. "Bryant was a visionary," he said. "She was a leader for our times." Smith of Equality Florida underscored the pain Bryant's rhetoric caused for queer people and families on the other ends of her attacks then and now. "With history repeating itself," Smith said, "it's important to remember that it took us uniting as a community and calling on our allies to very visibly stand with us to stop the damage. We're still here. We're still resisting. We're still turning the